Radio.
This talk is presented by Ryan and Karen Messmore on the topic, the Sacrament of Marriage, and was recorded at the Eyewitness Conference 2012 in Stanwell Tops, New South Wales.
It was a warm Friday evening in 1993 during our first semester at Duke University in North Carolina when our eyes met across a crowded chapel. To be accurate, I think my eye caught her blonde hair and radiant face, and I don't think she noticed me at all. But I was speechless. I was in the presence of feminine genius. I should have asked her name, but I was unable to muster up the courage to talk to her for another entire year.
We finally met when I enrolled in a class that he was teaching on the theology of C.S. Lewis through the Chronicles of Narnia. The day after class ended, he asked me to dinner, and we soon realized that we had feelings for each other.
And when we found ourselves about to embark on a relationship, we began to look for something that could give us guidance. What we wanted was a compelling story. We live as human beings according to stories. In fact, how you approach dating and marriage depends a great deal on what kind of story you and your larger culture are committed to.
One author summarizes today's common story about love this way. The good life is about being cool, looking hot, and seeking pleasure however you want it. Marriage is great when it's the culmination of romantic love story. But if the going gets tough, it's on to the next pleasure, end quote. This is a story whose center of gravity is a romantic feeling. It's a vision of love that maximizes individual choice and sexual freedom. In this story, the focus of marriage is on how happy I am, or how well the other person is meeting my needs. There's no larger purpose for marriage. What's missing is any sense that marriage is a common task or a public office that might call for preparation and training. In fact, today, people spend less time preparing to enter marriage than they do preparing to take exams, file taxes, or even run marathons. Even many Christians take their primary cues about romance and sex from Disney and Hollywood. And I know, Martha Stewart sets the terms for their weddings. As a result, young people in our churches develop unhealthy assumptions and expectations about love and married life.
Karen and I were disappointed with this dominant cultural script for romantic relationships. We wanted to live out a different kind of love story. We wanted our story to take part in a narrative with deeper meaning and purpose. And we wanted that narrative to be shaped by our Christian faith. But we didn't hear much from our church about what that should or could look like in practice. And so questions remained for us. Questions like, what is so special, yet alone holy, about sex and marriage? Why would a couple in love wait for marriage to have sex? And why does the church consider marriage a sacrament? As you know this weekend, sacraments are signs and instruments of grace. As signs, they point to God's generous love for us. And as instruments, they are channels through which His grace flows to us. But what does marriage have to do with pointing to God and receiving His grace? Upon looking for books that provide this sort of theological roadmap, we came up short. We found lots of tips and techniques about who should initiate dates and how to have great sex, and even some technical explanations of the sacramental nature of marriage. But what we did not find was that compelling narrative, that story that offers purpose and direction. So we did our own research, and we discovered a love story in the pages of Scripture that's more relevant to our romance than we'd ever imagined. It's a beautiful story. It's an incredibly relevant story. It's a story, quite simply, of covenant love.
In Old Testament Israel, and continuing through Jesus' time, the path towards marriage consisted of at least four stages. First, a couple's families discussed and agreed upon terms of a marriage covenant. Then, they sealed this covenant with a ritual. Third, the couple prepared the conditions for the covenant's fulfillment. And finally, they consummated their marriage as part of the official marriage or wedding proceedings. After this fourth stage, the couple and their families celebrated marriage's completion with a grand party.
So here's how the process would have worked for a typical Israelite couple. The fathers of the young man and woman met to work out the terms of the marriage covenant. And they wrote these terms down in a covenant document that both parties signed. And then the young man said to the young woman, very typical covenant forming phrases. He said, "Today I am your husband and you are my wife." And she responded in a similar fashion. Then the groom's father might pour a cup of wine and hand it to his son. Now the wine represented the blood of an animal. And when parties in that day were forming a covenant, they would kill an animal and sprinkle the blood as if to say to one another, "May the same be done to me if I fail to keep this covenant." The son then sipped the wine and said something like, "This cup represents a covenant in blood." He then handed the cup to his bride to sip. And this act sealed the betrothal. But typically, the groom also presented his bride with a betrothal gift, either in the form of money or a ring made of precious metal. Finally, the family celebrated a betrothal meal together. After that, the son returned home with his father and began building a room onto his father's house. And this addition to the house would be the new residence for he and his bride. It typically took up to a full year to complete. Now, during this time, if the betrothed woman entered a market or a public place, she would cover her face with a veil. And this signaled to other men in town that she was already betrothed, and it prevented the groom from seeing her until their wedding night. Now, upon completing the additional room, the young man gathered his family and friends together, and they set off on the appointed day to claim his bride. On that day, the bride's mother and bridesmaids helped her in a ritual bath that symbolized spiritual cleaning. Then they anointed her with perfumed oils, helped her into her wedding garments, and adorned her with jewels. You can see an example of this actually in Isaiah chapter 61, verse 10. Now, not knowing the precise hour her groom would come, the bride and her companions waited expectantly throughout the day and possibly even the night. Now, typically a friend ran ahead and announced the groom's arrival by blowing a ram's horn called a shofar. And after the groom claimed his bride, the couple processed back to their new home. Once there, the couple listened as the covenant document was read aloud. They repeated their solemn declaration, "I am your husband, you are my wife," and vice versa. They received a blessing and again sipped from that same cup of wine. Then, in a private room, they consummated their marriage covenant sexually. Friends of the groom actually guarded the door and at the appropriate time announced to the crowd that the consummation had taken place. And at that moment, you know, a roar of celebration was ring out from the crowd, and they would enter into a party which could last up to 7 days or even more. It's very public stuff.
Brian and I wondered how the story of covenant love in the scripture might inform our relationship, and how more broadly the biblical story could make a down-to-earth difference in the way that Christians approach dating, engagement, and weddings. Although we didn't want to follow the ancient Jewish marriage process in every detail,
which part?
We did appreciate the way in which it based marriage in faithfulness rather than solely romantic feelings. This brings to light how Scripture views love first and foremost as an action rather than an emotion. In 1 Corinthians 13, which is known as the love chapter, Paul uses 15 different descriptions of love: patient, kindness, does not envy, does not boast, and so on. In the original Greek, each of these 15 descriptors is a verb. And in John's Gospel, Christ speaks of love in terms of activities, washing one another's feet and laying down one's life for his friends. Verses like this convinced us that love isn't simply a sentiment or an emotion. True love has to do with a decision to give oneself for the good of another. So we committed to talk about love as a verb rather than a noun. This meant giving up phrases like fall in love and love at first sight. Instead, we spoke of love as something we do, not only something we feel, as an action, not just an attraction.
Which is why I now say that when I first saw Karen on that night in 1993, it was infatuation at first sight. Really. Love really is a verb, which means that if our story were to become a true love story, it would be, by definition, an action adventure. And if love is an action, it inevitably involves our bodies. As Pope John Paul II spoke about often, God intends our bodies to be a means of giving ourselves as gifts to the other. But when it comes to romance, our bodies often become the means of gratifying ourselves instead. This is one reason why self-control is so important to cultivate on this sort of journey. But how do you learn to control sexual urges without giving up all interaction with the other sex? Well, Karen and I cultivated romantic self-control by practicing saying no in other areas of our life. So, for example, when we began to get serious, we fasted one day every week for our relationship, saying no to the desire to eat food when we were hungry. And I remember very clearly that it was every Thursday, because as it so happens, it was always on a Thursday that some campus organization would offer free food as much as we could. It was always on that day that we were fasting. But I also tithed the money that I made from my part-time job, saying no to my desire to spend it on things like more food. And I observed the Sabbath every Sunday, saying no to my desire to study on that day for Monday's tests, even during final exam weeks. And we disciplined our tongues. I said no to my desire to tell Karen those three most powerful words that can melt and perhaps manipulate any girl's heart.
Want some chocolate?
I love you. It's these activities: fasting, tithing, observing the Sabbath, which enabled us to walk slowly through and even appreciate each stage of our physical relationship. So when we finally got to the point of holding hands, we so enjoyed it that we did not feel the need to rush quickly past it to the next stage. Instead, we just remained there in that stage of holding hands for weeks and weeks.
Our relationship was soon tested when we were separated by different study abroad opportunities. We wanted to keep our passion for each other alive, but we knew that the long-distance relationship would likely take a toll on the intensity of our feelings. But if love is a verb, then it doesn't depend solely on feelings or emotions, but on a commitment of the will. What would it look like to base our long-distance relationship on love as a verb? Being Americans, we drafted a constitution listing 7 specific actions we would commit to while we were apart. We both signed a copy of it And when things got rocky, if we had an argument or started to doubt our relationship, we knew the other person was actively doing those seven things.
I still carry it in my wallet to this day. And once that long distance relationship was over, thank goodness, and we were reunited, things pretty much went smoothly from there on out.
Until the talk on the ledge.
Right. The talk on the ledge. It's not my best moment. The summer after Karen returned from Vienna, I had read an article about the connection between marriage, sex, and procreation. And that article changed my views on natural family planning, or NFP. I decided after reading this article that once I was married, I would practice natural family planning. The only problem, I hadn't yet discussed this with my future wife. And when I did, I went about it completely wrong. We were sitting on the ledge outside of the music building on Duke's East Campus when, without warning, I naively turned to Karen and declared, artificial contraception is wrong, and all the objections we had to it hold no water at all. Well, she was caught off guard, as you can imagine, and remained silent as I proceeded to bombard her with philosophical arguments and technical distinctions.
And all I heard was, you should give up any hope of a future career so you can stay at home and raise at least 15 kids. I had heard all the typical jokes, such as, what do you call a couple practicing NFP? Parents. I wanted to smack him and run away as fast as I could.
This was a big issue for a couple moving toward marriage. It was a potential deal breaker. And I had handled it with the thoughtfulness and sensitivity of a rhinoceros.
Rhinoceros.
Thankfully, we worked through this issue and came to the same view. And NFP has worked perfectly for us for all 15 years of our marriage. We encourage all single women, and especially couples considering marriage, to learn how NFP works. That is, learn how a woman's signs can identify ovulation. It's inexpensive and relatively easy to learn and to practice. And when you want to get pregnant, you'll have a good idea of when during your cycle to try. But this is the important part. Learning to track your signs is easier, much easier, before rather than after you begin to be sexually active. We've known various couples who have waited until the month before they get married. And some couples, they've even tried to learn it after they were married, to learn how NFP works. Many of them ended up pregnant within a few months. But if you are not yet sexually active, take advantage of the time you have now to learn and practice NFP. It'll cost you little, but it could save you much stress and anxiety down the road.
One of the most important things that we did in our relationship was to seek pre-engagement counseling. Not premarital counseling, but pre-engagement counseling. We thought to ourselves, if premarital counseling takes place after engagement and right before the wedding, doesn't it come a bit late in the process? By the time many engaged couples enter counseling, they have already set the wedding date. They've already booked the ceremony and the reception sites, they've made the news public, and they've already sent invitations to every important person in their lives. He's already paid for the ring.
And she and her mother have already seen her in the dress.
And that's a lot of pressure to put on both the couple and the priest to have sessions turn out successfully. It would be terribly disappointing and sometimes embarrassing to call off or postpone a wedding due to unforeseen disagreements that came to light during counseling. So even when a couple realizes they've come to odds over an issue, like budget planning or whether or not to have children, they're tempted to overlook the trouble spot, complete the counseling, and proceed with the wedding as planned. Oh, we'll figure it out later. So we asked our pastor to take us through some of the same sort of counseling sessions that he does with couples preparing for marriage, but to do it with us before we got engaged. At the end of those sessions, we felt ready to enter into a covenant of love to begin to plan the wedding.
As we thought about the ancient Jewish marriage tradition, we liked the fact that it didn't view betrothal just as a declaration that the man and woman would one day enter a covenant in the future. But the betrothal itself was the point at which the covenant process was initiated, set in motion. And it was therefore approached with great gravity and intentionality. When it came time to pop the question, I wanted my proposal to Karen to symbolize our understanding of the commitment we would begin entering into at that moment. I desired our engagement to participate in the larger story of covenant marriage in the biblical tradition.
So, on a rainy April night, on the observation platform at the top of the Duke Chapel, Ryan got down on one knee in front of me. Using traditional covenant language, he declared that he wanted to be my husband, and he asked if I would be his wife. Ryan then poured wine into a crystal chalice and said, "This cup represents a covenant in blood." He took a sip and handed it to me to do the same. We then held each other close and danced in the rain. The huge spotlights that illumined the chapel each night shone up on us, casting our shadows against the low-hanging clouds. It was truly a profound moment. As we swayed to the music, I sensed that we were taking our place in a larger dance. We were tapping into something ancient and solemn, joyful and right. With the cup with which we had sealed our engagement, we toasted the author of the great love story.
Now, the tale told so far, desiring intimate bodily communion, entering the process of covenant making, preparing for its fulfillment, and celebrating its consummation. This is a story that follows the contours of a much deeper, ancient narrative, God's history with His creation. Scripture reveals God forming a covenant with His people that culminates in a one-flesh union between humanity and divinity. Indeed, the Bible describes God's relationship with His people in terms of a marriage covenant. Hosea speaks of God as a jealous husband, and John refers to John the Baptist as the friend of the groom. And in one of the narrative's most dramatic moments, the Son of God drinks from a cup of wine and says to His disciples, "This cup is my blood of the new covenant." To their ears, might this have sounded something like the sealing of a betrothal? Then what does He do? He tells His disciples that soon He will go to His Father's home to prepare rooms for them. And at an unexpected hour, He will return to claim His followers as His bride and bring us to share in the ultimate wedding banquet of the Lamb.
This story of salvation history shows us something about marriage. It's a covenant that has purposes beyond spouses' own happiness. Earthly marriage is meant to show the world God's kind of love, God's covenant faithfulness in earthly form. The Catholic Catechism says that the deepest reason why marriage is an unbreakable union is found in the, quote, fidelity of God to His covenant and that of Christ to His church. Through the sacrament of matrimony, the spouses are enabled to represent this fidelity and witness to it, end quote. So marriage is a sacrament in that it is a sign of God's faithful covenant love for the church.
And this larger biblical story also suggests something about sex. It's not just for recreation. It consummates and renews a covenant. Sex is covenant renewal. Did you ever think about that? Sex is covenant renewal. It has the potential to say to a spouse every single time, "You're still the partner I desire on this adventure. I once again give myself to you and to our marriage." Sex consummates and renews a covenant that is permanent, exclusive, and fruitful. And indeed, this is what grounds the various church teachings on sexual morality. Sexual acts are good and healthy, which are in line with the permanent, exclusive, and fruitful nature of the marriage covenant. But divorce is wrong because of the permanent nature of the marriage covenant. Adultery is wrong because of the exclusive nature of the marriage covenant. Homosexual acts and contraception are wrong because of the creative nature of the marriage covenant. Premarital sex is wrong because there is not yet any covenant to consummate or renew in the first place.
It also needs to be said that the church teaches the importance of vocation to singleness as well. The Catechism states that single persons, quote, deserve the special affection and active solicitude of the church. It also states that infertile couples can have a, quote, conjugal life full of meaning in both human and Christian terms. Their marriage can radiate a fruitfulness of charity, of hospitality, and sacrifice, end quote. So the church needs to support and care for these couples as well. And finally, marriage itself is not pure, happy ever after bliss. Living as a husband and wife poses many daily challenges. It requires a lot of hard work. It constantly reveals our sin and our sinful tendency to focus on ourselves rather than the other. Giving ourselves to our spouse as a gift doesn't come easily. Ryan and I have a long way to go in that department, but it helps us to know that our journey fits into a much deeper love.
When we sacrifice for the good of our spouse, when we remain faithful when the going gets tough and the feelings tend to ebb and flow, when we listen, when we serve, when we give ourselves as gifts to the other, then we participate in the larger story of God's love. We participate actually in the very nature of God Himself, who is love. Marriage is a rigorous training ground in loving and being loved, a training ground for conforming to Christ-likeness. In this way, it is a channel of God's grace to us. The biblical story we've discussed this morning is the larger story of romance and love and marriage into which God has invited Karen and me and all couples. This is the story that earthly engagements, weddings, and marriages are meant to echo. And it is this echo, this pointing to the larger story, that makes marriage such a beautiful and powerful sacrament. Thank you.
For more talks recorded at Eyewitness 2012, visit cradio.org.au or xt3.com. To find out more about the Eyewitness Conference, visit livetothefull.com.au. Cradio, nourishing the soul of the digital generation.